You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
I will be covering the case of Jacob Landine. Welcome back, everybody. I know it has been a while since I posted an episode. I've had some health struggles, but now I'm back and I'm ready to fight and advocate again for these victims and their families. Today, you'll be hearing an interview that I did with Eric Landine from True Crime Consequences. He's got an amazing podcast. I highly recommend you all look him up, subscribe, and start listening to his cases that he covers. Eric has a true heart and true compassion for these cases that he covers. He's fighting to change the way that New Mexico handles these child cases. Eric is knowledgeable not only about the true crime community and what it faces when fighting for these cases, but he's very knowledgeable about his state and what they face when it comes to fighting for justice. Eric and I sat down and talked about the case that got him into fighting and advocating for these other cases. Eric's baby brother, Jacob, was just 9 months old in 1987 when he was murdered by his stepfather. We will not be releasing the suspect's name. This is still an open investigation, but more importantly, we do not believe that his name matters. His history, his story, where he grew up, or where he came from. What matters is he's a monster that stole the life of a baby, that terrorized Eric and his mother years after he murdered this innocent child. This conversation is live, so there's a few little glitches here and there. And some of the conversation sounds as if we're talking over one another, but we're not. It's just the way that the audio laps during the live. We had an open forum, so you'll hear us answering questions in the chat room as we discuss this case. Jacob's case is a hard one. We understand that child murder is hard for a lot of people. That does not mean that Jacob's name should not be out there. It does not mean that we should not listen to Jacob's story and learn from it. Jacob's voice was stolen before he even had a chance to gain one. So as a community, as advocates, as human beings, we need to stand up and shout for him as loud as we can. I hope after listening to this interview, you can understand the passion, the anger, and the frustration that we all feel when we came across this case. I hope it awakes something inside you that makes you want to help too. The biggest way you can help is simply sharing his story. I will be adding links and the description on how you can get to Eric's page that he has set up along with his TikTok and his Twitter. This one's a hard one, guys. So strap in, grab your tissues, and let's raise Jacob's voice.
I have to tell you right off the bat, I cried so hard for this case. So hard. Kids hit me hard all the time. But woo, this one got me real good.
It's a rough one.
It is a rough one. It's a rough one because I see multiple victims in one scenario. So, I mean, of course, it's your story, your brother's story. So where do you want to start?
I'm not sure. I always kind of go through it chronologically. So, but I don't know if that's the best way to do it or not. It's just the way my brain works because I can't have a hard time bouncing around.
Right. yeah, I think whatever works best for you, you know, I know a lot of people here have an idea of who Jacob is, but for the people that aren't listening, I definitely want them to chronologically understand why this case is so important. Being a kid in the system, I know how these things escalate and how they get to where they are. And I believe the only way that we prevent that in the future is by teaching people the signs to look for. So,
yeah, I think it's important to start by talking about the fact that it's been 33 years since my brother was murdered. And it's been 33 years without justice. It's definitely been a struggle for my mom and I. There's been times where we've just felt like we've been left kind of holding the bag, so to speak, in the sense that for the longest time, the prosecutors and people in the state have not really even acknowledged what happened, and somewhat treated us like we were making a big deal out of nothing, which was almost as traumatizing as losing him.
It's like losing him again.
Yeah. And for sure. And also just being, just feeling like you start to question your sanity a little bit. Like, did I make this whole thing like worse than it is? Why is nobody else feeling the way that we feel about this? Like, why is nobody else seeing that the murder of a baby is horrifying, and why is nobody wanting to do anything about it? Those things have been, I think, the hardest to deal with.
Do you ever find yourself still, as a child of abuse? I can definitely say I find myself sometimes going, well, maybe it wasn't as bad because no one else is listening. Do you ever feel like, even now, question that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you start to kind of fall into that whole brainwashing mindset that was there, you know, back then. My stepfather was very good at that, at convincing us that we were crazy and that we were the ones that were wrong. And so it's easy to slip back into that and to start second guessing everything. And then of course that brings up all these other feelings and everything else. That's really hard to deal with. So I think that's kind of like the first point I want to make, is that it's been this long and there's been some movement, but not enough movement. The other thing that's really important to know is that so I kind of see it, not that I'm like the center of the universe, right? But like, this is like a signpost in New Mexican history of kind of a systematic problem that we have here. And it continues to happen. So there's countless cases of kids who have been murdered as a result of child abuse in this state. And, you know, you look at cases like in California, like the Gabriel Fernandez case, this is the kind of thing that's happening all the time in this state. And the reason I started my podcast was to bring this out into the open, because people don't necessarily want to hear these horrible stories because they're horrible. I remember seeing people commenting about the Gabriel Fernandez documentary, like, oh, this is too much for me. And I understand, I get it.
Yeah.
But if they're not willing to look at this, then it's not going to stop. If we're not willing to talk about this, then it's not going to stop. And so if you want this to stop, we have to face it. We can't hide from it. Yeah.
Exactly. There was a poignant moment when your mom said, I listened to your podcast and, oh my goodness, I just had to sit on the floor and cry for a little bit, because there's a point where she says, I was 26. I didn't know. And I feel like if we educate everyone, maybe someone in her life would have been able to go, hey, this is a flag. This is a, this is something you should be paying attention to. Or even if she, it was a publicly educated thing, she could have noticed something. And I, no matter how many times she says she doesn't blame herself, you, as a mother, you hear it in her heart. She blames herself.
Yeah. You know, somebody had asked on a subsequent episode, because I did three parts on Jacob's story. They'd asked if we were worried about people blaming her, if she was worried about people blaming her. And my answer to that is, I don't think anybody can blame her as much as she's blamed herself over the last 33 yeah. years, which is heartbreaking for me, because she was very much groomed. She was very much love bombed. She was very much in a situation where it did seem impossible. It really did. And so I just don't think that people can understand that unless they've been there, I guess.
Right.
But I guess we can start at the beginning.
Who this beautiful little boy was.
Oh, Jacob. He, even as a baby, he had a huge personality. He was crazy. He was a daredevil. And he brought so much joy into our family. Sorry.
No, you're good. You're good. I don't know how you do this every time, because just reading documents, like I said, listening to it, I had dreams about him last night. Like, it's one that gets you, because you can tell he was this amazing light. So to lose a light from like that in this world is hard. It's very hard.
Yeah. I prayed for him. So my dad is a Pentecostal evangelist, or he was. He passed away this year from COVID.
Oh, sorry.
He was a Pentecostal evangelist, and there were a lot of challenges in my parents' relationship. The biggest one was that my dad would just leave for weeks at a time, and my mom would be left trying to figure out how to manage the household without any money coming in. And it was very challenging. But I remember, and I kind of feel bad about it now that I see it as an adult, when my mom was going through that, I was like praying for this other sibling, which probably put a more difficult financial strain on our life. But I prayed for him. And he showed up, and he was massive. He was 10 pounds when he was born. He was this incredible child that I immediately fell in love with. I remember just being so enamored with him and wanting him to be everywhere that I was, and wanting him to, just wanting to be close to him, wanting to hold his hand or get his bottle for him, or, you know, just whatever I could do to help. And then he got bigger and older and started kind of talking a little bit. He would do this thing where he had this old fashioned swing. It wasn't old fashioned then, but it is now. It was basically a death trap, because, you know, the 80s. And
was it the wind up?
Yeah, it was totally the wind up one. But it also was like made of this really flimsy, I don't know if it was aluminum or steel, but it was like,
they were aluminum,
very sharp for some reason. I was, to answer your question, Ron, I was 5 when Jacob was born. But he did this thing where the swing would go forward and he would grab the front legs and he would throw the entire thing backwards. And the first time he did it, we were horrified. Like, everybody jumped out of their seat and they were like, oh my God, what's going on? And he just sat there and laughed. And his laugh was like no other laugh I've ever heard. He did this kind of like, like, it was so weird. But he would lay there and laugh. And after a while, we just got used to him doing that, because he did it all the time. He loved throwing the entire thing backwards and lying on the ground. I remember another time that he was in the kitchen pulling all of the drawers out of the kitchen counters. And there was cutlery flying all around him. And he's just laughing. Like, he thought it was the best thing that ever happened to him. He was crazy.
No fear.
And I don't think that the world was ready for Jacob Lundin. He was a little bit out of control, and I bet he would have been a terror as a teenager, and probably given my mom a stroke or something. But he made our lives very exciting and very interesting. It was never boring. It was always fun. I just remember that about him. So that was Jacob.
He liked to keep you on your toes.
He kept everybody on their toes. But he was also so loving and affectionate and happy. He was just always happy. My parents separated when I was five. I think Jacob was probably 5 or 6 months old. And my dad was having an emotional relationship with another woman. And my mom found out about it. And so she had had enough. She was done dealing with that. So we moved away back to New Mexico. We were living in Texas at the time. And we moved back in with my grandparents. And that's when this, I don't even know what to call him. Shit bag.
Yeah, there's not a good word. I mean, monster isn't good enough for what he is.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not.
So he was my dad's best friend. And he started.
That's an interesting dynamic for me that he didn't ever. I always wonder when you say that, like, did he ever question him, see anything bad in him?
Nobody did. Nobody. He was charismatic. He was gregarious. He was friendly. He was happy. At least that was the image that he portrayed to everybody. Everybody liked him. Everybody thought he was great and wonderful. And my mom and I also believed this about him. So he started showing up and kind of inserting himself into our lives and immediately started love bombing us, which we didn't know what that was back then. But we learned later what it is. And it's exactly what he did. He showered us with gifts and compliments and attention. And I was somewhat starved for a father figure at this point. Because
your dad was always
gone. My mom, I think, was starved for affection. And yeah, I would say that she was vulnerable at the time. And so he immediately kind of consumes our family dynamic. And before my mom knows it, she's in a relationship with this man. And everything seemed great. All I knew was he had a really cool car. He had a race car. And he liked to watch movies like The Terminator and things that I thought were really cool at the time. He loved to eat candy. And I love to eat candy. So that was like a good situation for me. I was not ashamed for wanting candy in that situation. It was like totally acceptable for us to just constantly be eating it. And so everything seemed okay. And then weird stuff started to happen to Jacob. He started to have bruises on his body. He had a brain or a head injury, and he had to have he had a lump on his head. It had to be lanced and drained. I was blamed for that. I was told that I was jealous of him and that I kicked him in the head. I didn't want to cause problems, so I just kind of went along with what everyone was saying. I don't know. I might have been jealous of Jacob. I don't remember being jealous of Jacob, but I remember being jealous of his name. I thought that he had a cooler name than I did, and I was mad about that. until my grandmother told me that my name meant princely. And then I was like, oh, cool. I'm good now. Like, you can keep your name.
Totally good.
but I don't remember being jealous of Jacob. It's possible that I was, you know.
I think there's sibling rivalry, jealousy. My biggest one with the first incident like that, draining laceration, I was CNA and registration and emergency room. And we would have seen that. And I get now we're in, you know, the 2000s, things are different. It was way different than it was in the 80s. But I just don't know, as a nurse, a doctor, a registration officer that was in there, a social worker, how that first one wasn't addressed, or there wasn't even at least a social worker that came in and sat and had like a conversation just to kind of narrow out what could have possibly, because kids fall. My husband went down as a baby in his walker down a set of stairs in the 80s, and his parents were greeted at the emergency room by social workers and police officers. So there's a big, big red flag that this was missed the first time.
So this did open an investigation with Child Protective Services. But I learned this later. My mom was not made aware of this. The social worker showed up when my mom was at work, and my stepfather basically chased them away. And I learned about this later. I didn't know. My mom didn't even know that this had happened. But a neighbor actually had called and reported that Jacob was crying a lot. And so this, coupled with the injury, started an investigation, but it didn't go anywhere. Once the social worker was chased off, then it was just over, I guess. Like, you meet just the tiniest bit of resistance and you stop. That doesn't make any sense at all to me.
Right. And how she wasn't, why you would address anybody but the mother. The biological mother is where I'm like confused at the hospital, why she wasn't addressed or she wasn't
100%
talk to it.
And also for the neighbor to call, like, it had to have been really bad, because like, I mean, it's not even like they're in the same house, like next door. So it had to have been pretty loud. Which really bothers me. So, you know, stuff started kind of piling up. Things kept getting weirder. My mom now believes that something is up. She doesn't know exactly what is up. I'm being blamed for all of this. And so she decides she's going to send me to California with my dad to protect me. And I left, and this stuff kept happening. It didn't stop. My mom found sunflower seed shells in Jacob's crib. There were more unexplained injuries. And there was an incident where my grandmother was watching Jacob. And like I said before, he was crazy. He was a daredevil. He was out of control. And my grandma goes to pick him up above her head and kind of play with him like you do with babies. And he started panicking and screaming and grabbing at her hair, clutching her hair. And my mom picks up Jacob, and my grandmother's like, I'm really worried that something's wrong, because normally Jacob likes me to pick him up above my head. He likes me to play with him like that. And today he started freaking out, and this is so out of character for him. And so my grandma shows my mom, and he does the same exact thing. And so my mom goes to her boyfriend and confronts him and says, hey, are you playing rough with Jacob? Like, what's going on? And he's like, oh no, I didn't do anything. And so he's like, all I do. And he goes to pick up Jacob, and Jacob is practically trying to jump out of his hands into my mom's arms, screaming and crying. And so my mom starts to limit how much time Jacob is allowed to be with him. It's basically, Jacob is about 9 months old at this point. And she stops letting Jacob be alone with him. And she's obviously very suspicious at this point. I'm out of the picture. Things keep happening. So one night in April, 1987, Jacob's 9 months old. My mom is working. My grandmother calls her and she says, "Hey, I'm wanting to go to church. What should I do with Jacob?" My mom was feeling, I guess, like she felt bad for my grandmother. So she said, "Well, I guess you can take him to my boyfriend's house because I get off in an hour." And so immediately my mom starts to panic. She just has this really bad feeling about everything. And she starts begging her boss to let her get off work early. And her boss is like, "No, you know, you need to work the rest of your shift." So she starts to busy herself so she doesn't think about it. And then a pretty big rush of customers comes in. She's working in a grocery store at this time. I don't know if I said that. And within, I would say, half an hour of Jacob being dropped off, my mom's boyfriend runs in to the grocery store and he's panicking. And at the same time, an ambulance is going by really fast on the main road in the town that we were in. And he's telling my mom that Jacob is unresponsive and he doesn't know what happened. And so they go to the hospital. And Jacob's injuries are so severe that he has to be airlifted to Albuquerque, which is about 75 miles away. And they take him to Presbyterian Hospital. And his injuries are so bad that Presbyterian Hospital can't help him. So they rush him to the only trauma center we have in Albuquerque. And he's rushed into emergency surgery. And he doesn't make it through his surgery. So,
take your time. That's a rough one. It really is.
Yeah, I kind of rushed through that. Sorry.
No, you're good. And I think from what I understood from reading everything, the time that the suspect had him was such a short amount of time that this was basically the second he got his hands on this child, he started mm-hmm. hurting this child. And then just the process of transportation to transportation to transportation, really, and him taking the time to actually reach out for help is what kind of escalated everything to where he wasn't able to make it through that last surgery.
he had a, according to the autopsy, it was blunt force trauma to the head that was the cause of death for him. Subdural hematoma. So he was bleeding inside his brain. And my mom and my grandparents and her boyfriend all rushed. They had to drive. So it was about an hour's drive to get there. By the time my mom got there, she was able to see him. She saw him for a minute. He took a big breath. And then he was taken to surgery, I think, is what happened. And he didn't make it out. And the entire time, the doctor noted in his report that my mom's boyfriend kept saying something along the lines of, "This isn't going to look good for me. This doesn't look good for me." He just kept saying that over and over again. And the doctor even noted, I think you probably saw that in the file, that he was more concerned about himself. Like, he never once asked if Jacob was okay. He never once seemed even remotely worried about Jacob, who was in brain surgery. He was more worried about himself the entire time, which is
and how this was gonna
and how my mom was going to react. There was never any concern for Jacob. Bron, I don't understand your question. Was Jacob in ambulance when he went to your mom? I don't think I understand that.
Oh, was Jacob already in the ambulance when the suspect ran to get? Yeah. I think with that one, what I see is you have those manipulators, but then you have someone that they feel like they're standing in front of that they can't manipulate, and the facade starts to break. So they start to try to ask these questions about themselves, not seeming like that's where it's going. But I think he knew the way that that doctor looked at him, because I've seen it happen in the ER. They look at them, they don't play. They know exactly. And I think he saw it right then. This guy doesn't believe me. This guy knows what I did.
So he immediately starts making up stories. I think he had 4 or 5 different variations of what happened. So I'm going to kind of backtrack a little bit. So I'm in California with my dad. I'm in a completely new school, new state. It's probably like 4 or 5 in the morning, and my dad wakes me up and tells me we have to rush to New Mexico because there's been an accident. My brother is in the hospital. And so we fly to Albuquerque. We were picked up at the airport by my mom. Jacob has already passed away at this point. We didn't know that until we got to the airport. And I just remember seeing my mom and the heartbreak on her face, the shock on everyone's faces. And we were all immediately pulled into separate rooms and interviewed separately. My grandmother was pulled into a different room. My mom was pulled into a room, her boyfriend, and then my dad and I were pulled into an interview with the police, the state police. And they started asking me about the allegations that I had hurt Jacob and that I was jealous of him. And I remember being very afraid, like sitting in front of the police officer, feeling like I had done something wrong and being very nervous. And so they asked me if I had ever hurt Jacob, and I got very agitated. That's what they said in the report. I don't remember that. And eventually I said no. And then they started to ask me if my mom's boyfriend had ever hit me. And I think I said something along the lines of, he hasn't hit me, but he acts like he's going to. And, yeah, that was a pretty traumatizing experience as well. Yeah, I thought maybe I was going to go to prison or something. I didn't really understand what was going on.
Well, it's trauma rolling on top of trauma, rolling on top of trauma.
But in his interview, and there's bits and pieces of it in the file, it's not very clear. I don't want to necessarily say, I know that like Fern would probably say this, but I feel like they could have done a better job documenting.
Oh, yeah. I'll say it 100%. They could have done a better job because we have a supposed confession. We have, but that's all lost.
So I feel like the document, it alludes to some stuff. It's not very clear, but it does say that there are several iterations, and it does give some of those. So I think one of the stories that he gave was that he was dubbing cassette tapes. That's been pretty consistent in his story. He was dubbing cassette tapes, and he set Jacob onto the couch, and he turned around, Jacob fell off, hit his head on the coffee table, and then was vomiting. Okay, that's story one. Story two was he was dubbing cassette tapes, and Jacob started fussing a little bit, so he picked him up and lost his grip, and Jacob's head hit the arm of the armchair in the living room. Which would be sharp. Both of those would be sharp force trauma injuries. They would not be blunt force trauma injuries.
Exactly.
There was another one where he claimed that he was lying on his back, and Jacob's head was like resting on his neck for some reason, which doesn't make any sense either. And he got up really fast and hit Jacob in the head with his head. Maybe, I don't know, but this was like on the top of Jacob's head. This was not, you know, yeah. It wasn't.
No, baby's headbutt all the time. I mean, my friends have had broken nose. They headbutt, and no, we don't see that.
Yeah, Fern, it was right on top of his head. So there's no way that those injuries that he was describing would have happened and resulted in what happened to Jacob. So that's he. So we have red flag of no concern for Jacob. We have red flag of all these stories that don't line up with what actually happened. And so then it gets weird, like kind of fuzzy. We have the funeral. My mom is not talking to him at this time. And I didn't really understand what was happening until one day we're at my grandparents' house and her boyfriend pulls up and my grandfather runs out of the house as fast as he can. And he rushes up to the car and he starts yelling. And he's like, "Why don't you hit somebody who can talk, you piece of shit?" And her boyfriend backs out really fast, peels out, takes off. And that's when I started to suspect that he was responsible for what happened to Jacob. I'm going to get some water.
An interesting thing I noticed is it was always when it was just him and you and Jacob together to begin with, that these things happened. I can totally see where Eric is jealous, because Eric's going to get to see soon what exactly is going to go on here and is going to start speaking. Jacob can't speak. So the only thing I can do is to divide them. By simply saying that he is a threat, and knowing how much your mother loved your children, her children, she is going to do whatever it is to protect both of you, whether you were a threat or not, she was still going to love you and try to put you in the best situation. I don't know if other people have asked this question, and I'm sure, I don't know if you've asked your mother this question, and if you don't want to answer it, that is perfectly fine. Why didn't Jacob go with you? Why couldn't your dad have Jacob too?
I've not asked my mom that question. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Your dad didn't have a very super stable situation.
We were living in a friend's house. It felt like it was like a converted garage situation. We were sleeping on bunk beds together.
And Jacob does probably need it, mom, more than you need it.
Yeah.
Not that you didn't need your mom, but an infant needs that more.
Well, and I think
dedicated time. I just didn't know.
Because I was in school and my dad was working in California and my mom had childcare with my grandmother for the most part. So I think that was probably part of it.
Okay. That makes sense.
So he kept, do you think the suspect planted the idea of you leaving in your mom? Maybe it's possible. Yeah. He might've planted that idea.
I think he definitely did with the start. I think he's the one that started the jealous of, and that's a perfect of reflection, because I think he was jealous because he only went after Jacob. Like you said, he might've raised his hand like he would or act like he would. I think it was less that you could talk, but I think he felt Jacob took her time and her love in a way that he couldn't compete with.
Yeah. I mean, and you start to see that in his behavior later as well, like his possessiveness and his controlling nature. So one of the things my mom told me that was kind of shocking was that he kept trying to get her to talk to him, and he would leave her all these letters on the car or at work for her, or drop them off at family members to have them give them to her. And almost all of those letters say that he wants to meet her at the graveyard at Jacob's grave, which was really weird. Who does that?
Huge red flag. I tried to understand his play there.
My mom thinks
that play is there.
It's an isolated area. She thinks that he was going to kill her. So.
Wow. Okay. I mean, because maybe she was starting to finally see through everything. Either take me back mm-hmm. and live this lie with me, or I now.
Well, and he's at risk, right? He's at risk now because people are seeing through his facade. And so something happened. They ended up back together. I don't know what it was. But I remember this very clearly. The state police brought him in for a polygraph examination. And we went with him. So it was in Santa Fe, which is a 2-hour drive from where we lived. And we were waiting in the car for, I would say, at least 2 hours. It could have been longer than that. And he comes strolling out, basically like in a really good mood. And my mom's like, how did that go? And he said, it's fine. I passed. And so we left. And we didn't think anything of it. So for those of you that have not heard this story, just keep that in the back of your mind. A lot of the things with the autopsy report I'll get into in a minute, because these are things we didn't really know about back then, because this information wasn't given to us. One of the questions that the police asked my mom on the night of Jacob's death was if she thought her boyfriend was capable of hurting Jacob like this. And she said, I don't think so. And that was later used against her. And I'll get to that in a minute as well. But I want to point that out. Like, we didn't think that he was capable of this. We thought he was this great guy. And he was my dad's best friend. So we didn't expect him to be capable of this.
No mother thinking that someone capable of hurting their child is going to hand yeah. someone their child. Yeah.
So we're living with him and things start escalating pretty quickly. He starts becoming violent with my mom and, very controlling and manipulating and anything really. Oh, yeah, Alex, there was no evidence that I could see of shaken baby syndrome. I didn't see anything that showed that, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't there. It just isn't in the report. and the report is missing a lot of stuff. So, there would be times where I would look at him. He would say something and I would look up at him. And suddenly, he says that I'm giving him dirty looks. And my mom would say something probably along the lines of, he just looked at you, and now he's beating the shit out of my mom. And this kind of stuff happened, you know, pretty regularly. And every time it happened, and my mom was expected to be somewhere, or we were expected to be somewhere as a family, he would line us up and we would have to go through the story with him over and over and over and over and over again until he felt like we had it right. And so if someone asks if, you know, what happened to your mom, what are you going to say? She was in a motorcycle accident, or she fell off a horse, or whatever the story was for that day was what we were supposed to do. And we knew that if we fucked it up, it was over. That was it. There would be hell to pay. So we did. We lied. We did our best. He had two kids. They lived with us part-time. They were in on it too. we all had to smile, act like everything's fine. If we were caught, you know, not doing any of those things, we would be punished.
What was your relationship with the other kids from his previous relationship? Trauma bond?
It's weird to me to think about that now because I didn't really understand because it wasn't nearly as bad when they were there. Like, it was bad, but it was never as bad as when it was just me. So it was always way worse when they weren't there. Yeah.
It was like, it was spread out.
And so when they were I think there. Probably because they would go to their mom and they could tell her what was happening. So it was always less intense when they were there. I think we had an okay relationship. I do suspect that they had some trauma from him as well. I don't really want to get into that. But I do suspect that there was some abuse there. So his daughter was a year older than me and his son was a year younger than me. So we were all, you know, within a year. No.
Are you close now?
No.
No.
So the abuse kind of escalates and there were some things he did to me. Like, he would lock me in my room for, you know, 9-10 hours a day. I wouldn't be allowed to use a restroom if he didn't feel like I needed it. So there were days where I wouldn't be able to use a restroom the entire day. He put a refrigerator in my room full of drinks and snacks and stuff so that I would not bother him. And I was basically like a prisoner. He would lock my bedroom from the outside, so I couldn't open the door. So one day, my mom and him are having a massive, massive fight. And his kids are actually here for this. And it's horrible. My mom is just screaming nonstop. And suddenly, she stopped. And I started to panic. And so I broke my window in my bedroom and I ran outside and I started throwing rocks at their bedroom window, like as big as I could hold. And I busted their window open and he comes running out to chase me and I go taken off to the neighbor's house. I learned later that at that very moment, my mom was losing consciousness. He had wrapped a wire hanger around her neck and he was strangling her. And if I had not, done that, she thinks that she would have likely died. But that gave her enough time to get out of the house and to run away. And even then, we still stayed there and he would say things in front of me to my mom, like, the only way you're leaving me is in a body bag. And we believed him. And so,
of course you believed him because you lost Jacob. You knew at that point what he was absolutely capable of.
So,
doing.
So I think we're with him from the time I'm 6 until about almost 11 years old. Maybe I was 11 or 10.
Ooh, those are some formative years.
And one night, my mom's at work. And he starts to sexually abuse me. And he tells me that if I ever say anything, he's going to kill my mom. So I didn't say anything.
Because you believed him. Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's.
But at the same time, he's trying to groom my cousin, and she's 14, and he didn't know what she was like, because I think that if he knew that, he would have not done that. He's calling to my grandparents' house where she lives and trying to get her to come over so that he can abuse her, and tells her not to say anything because nobody's going to understand. Nobody's going to get it. And she, she never cares. She never cares about what she says or what anybody thinks about what she says. And if somebody tells her not to do something, she's going to do it. So she told everybody, and she saved us. She saved me, because that was what my mom needed. That was a fire that she needed to get away from this man. And I'm always going to be grateful for that, because she did what I couldn't do.
Not what you couldn't do. I don't ever want you to feel like something you couldn't do. He literally put you in a place where you had no choice. I don't think it's fair to put that on yourself.
Thank you. Yeah, so we left.
Of course.
And he stalked us for a good 2 to 3 years. He would go to my bedroom window in the middle of the night and knock on it and say, I'm going to fucking kill you. I'm going to kill your mom. And no one's going to know. And this happened for a couple of years. I mean, now I see it. Like, back then it was just like, oh, shit. But now I can see that he was trying to intimidate us.
You're right.
from going forward to the authorities. And it worked.
Also wanted, he had control so long, and he wanted his victims back. There's a huge part of that where they,
yeah,
to have to go out and groom more victims, to have to take the chance that they're going to stand up and say something when you already have victims you feel like you can control, you feel like you've got that mm-hmm. power on, and you lose them, you're going to do everything in your power to get them back. So yeah. It's a double-sided sword for you guys.
But my mom went to the DA and the police and asked to reopen the investigation into Jacob's murder. And the DA said, why would I do that? You're only changing your story now because you're going through a divorce.
She was a female, right, DA? No? No, it was the first reporting detective was the female. Yeah. I'm trying to... Okay.
So Lee Deschamps was the DA at the time. And he was a fucking piece of shit then. And he's a fucking piece of shit today. And I will say that as loud as I possibly can.
Agreed.
Every interaction I've ever had with him on anything has always been horrible. Luckily, he's not the DA now. No, Brian, he's not. But the subsequent DAs weren't much better than him. So the police and the DA all treated my mom like she was this woman scorned who had a vendetta and was only trying to cause problems for her poor ex-husband who everybody likes. He played basketball with the entire police department every Saturday. He was friends with them. He worked for the county. He had keys to every county office. He couldn't possibly have been responsible for this, according to them. So nothing happened. And we, like I said, we felt like maybe we're making this worse than it is. Maybe we are the bad people. Maybe we're the ones causing problems. And it wasn't until we had quite a bit of separation in 2005 that my mom reached out to a cold case investigator with the state police. And that's where we got this case file from, was from him. And he, under no uncertain terms, basically said that this guy's responsible for Jacob's death. Now, there was no way to prove if it was intentional or not, if it was negligent or malicious. But it's clear that he was the one that was responsible. And so he forwarded this case after his review to the DA, a new DA, and asked them to reopen the case and to press charges. And they said, first the DA said that there were a number of issues that would prevent him from pressing charges. And first and foremost would be the statute of limitations, which, I've learned recently is not a thing.
I was fuzzy on that. I was like, what statute of limitations?
It
I was
used hoping to be
explain what he meant by that.
That, child abuse resulting in death, which is a classification here. It's much easier to prove than, first degree murder. The burden of proof is a lot lower. And so prosecutors will often defer to that charge because it carries a heavy penalty sometimes, especially for a first time offender. That penalty could be heavier than if they, you know, tried to prosecute, or the fear would be that they try to prosecute first degree murder and it gets thrown out because there's not enough evidence to prove it. So they'll go to child abuse resulting in death, and they can go either intentionally caused or negligently caused. The penalty for negligently caused is lower, but it's also easier to prove. But so back then there was a statute of limitations on that charge. That was reversed
mind-boggling
sometime in the early 2000s by the state Supreme Court. And so, there was even a statute of limitations on murder in New Mexico back then. And so that's all been taken away, and the case law shows that it has been proven to be, possible to be grandfathered in, even though at the time that this happened, there was a statute, the Supreme Court basically said that that doesn't matter. So it is retroactive, Prawn, is what I found out recently. I just learned that last month, honestly. And I can't tell you about how I learned about it or anything like that. So, but I do know that now. And so that was his first thing. His second thing was, we have something called speedy trial in New Mexico. And what that means is, the second you're charged with a crime, you're entitled as a defendant to a speedy trial. So basically, the prosecutor has to do everything they can to move the trial along as fast as possible. There can't be any delays for dramatic effect or anything like that. So, excuse me. So he said, based on those two things, he's not able to prosecute. And this is in 2005. Alex, I don't know what ex post facto means. But if you explain it to me, maybe I can answer that question.
A lot of words.
And you can jump on and explain it if you want. You don't have to type it.
Definitely.
Yeah, so it does apply to cases that were before the law was passed. Yes. Yes. And so, yeah, it was challenged in the first case, and the Supreme Court ruled that it was retroactive. Can't be applied to a current case. Okay. So that's what the district attorney thought, but that's been, a higher authority has claimed that that is not the case. I'll just say that, and I'll leave that there, and you guys can figure it out. Okay, cool. I think you put the pieces together, Alex. Okay, so, but what happened was we didn't know any of the other details about this because we didn't have access to this information until my mom requested some of the documents from the DA. They gave her a bunch. She got a copy of the cold case investigator report, but she didn't get everything. But that's when we learned that the doctor or the coroner said that the trauma to Jacob's head was similar to the open hand of an adult male, that the injury was consistent with that size. That doesn't mean that, that's exactly what it was, but it's just was an observation that the ME made.
I promise you that is what that doctor saw on the CAT scan that he did too. Yeah, I promise you he saw that on the CAT scan before he went in.
He knew.
That's why he looked at him when he came out.
So
he knew.
I'm not sure if it means the bleeding was that size. They just said that that's what the injury was consistent with.
Right. Because there was no bruising apparent, right? And that's a big thing in the emergency room that we spot right away. That is children of the 80s and the 90s that were lucky not to be abused, let me tell you. Open hand, there was also a big trend. I don't know if you ever heard about the phone book beatings, where you would you stack a book that can bend or curve over your child. And you beat them with a blunt object, and what it does is it keeps
bleeding.
The bruising from happening, but it causes all the internal damage.
So we also learned that he confessed in his interview with the state police. Well, we don't. Correct. Well, no, the state police, he didn't play ball
with.
That was the local police. What we don't know is what that confession was. There is no transcript. There is no recording. There's no documentation other than the one little sentence in the police report that says, the sergeant said a polygraph would not be necessary in as much as the suspect confessed. That's the only reason we knew that there was a confession. And the only reason we learned that is because I requested the documents this year. And I read them. So that was new information. We had no idea that he had confessed. And so who knows what happened to his confession. The other thing that I learned is that he did not pass the polygraph. He failed the polygraph. That was pretty shocking for my mom and I, because we believed the whole time that he had passed it. And I think those were like the most notable things that came out of us reading these documents. It's pretty clear that he's responsible. What's not clear is I'm convinced that it was intentional, but I think that a prosecutor is going to have a very hard time proving that, especially this many years later. So my expectation, if the DA ever decides to reopen this case, is that they'll go for child abuse resulting in death negligently caused, because that's probably the only thing that they can prove, you know, at this point. So there's a lot of problems with it. The biggest problem is that he has no record, which is shocking. There's more victims.
I guarantee you there's more.
Which tells me that maybe his relationships with law enforcement and county officials continue and have continued for the last 33 years. And that's alarming. If you ask me, it's alarming, because there's no way he changed his behavior. There's just no way. Might be. Yeah, but we don't know. You know, these people would have to come forward. So Bron said we might be able to build up a witness file, and we don't know who those people are. We don't know. I mean,
they're going to open that trauma up or be willing to put out that you've been abused mentally, physically, sexually to the whole world comes with an internal blame, an internal shame, and yep. some people bury it and don't ever touch it.
I think that if they could do that, they could show a pattern.
That's hard.
You know, which could make an argument. But the what bothers me the most is that they could have made these arguments in the 80s and the early 90s, but they didn't.
90s, yeah.
And that's, to me, that's complete negligence on the part of the DA. It's complete negligence on the part of the police because they refused to do anything. My mom's getting her ass kicked every single day and almost dying. When we reported my sexual abuse, they did nothing. Nothing happened. So there's a lot of looking the other way. And so I think that the DA is going to have a very hard time wanting to dredge all that up. So right now I have a petition for the Attorney General to look at the case. I agree, Alex. They could have easily made the case then. It's too late now. But I'm requesting that the Attorney General step in and intervene. Fern just copied and pasted that in there. Thank you, Fern.
Thanks, Fern.
I'm thinking about petitioning the DA now that I know about the statute of limitations, because jurisdiction lies with the DA. It is the DA's case. And so I'm considering that. I'm waiting. I have a friend in that was a former prosecutor, and I'm leaning on her for some advice on that right now. And I can't talk a lot about what's going on. There's been some stuff that's happened, but I'm just waiting to see. And once I know exactly what's going on, then maybe I'll have more concrete things that can be done, like reaching out to the DA. But right now I'm leaning on the petition. Really what I need help with is getting Jacob's story out there, to let people know that this has happened, because that's been the hardest thing for me. I've had some amazing people that have worked on this case and helped me cover it, like Fern, you. But I need more exposure. I need more attention. I'm sharing it on TikTok. I'm sharing it on social media. If you see that, please help me share Jacob's story. Tell people to. Right.
We need, tell people to listen to it. NBC.
That's what I need. I need help making this massive. Because if they're going to hide behind the fact that they screwed up so much, then I need to bring that out into the open so that there's nothing for them to hide from anymore. I am on Facebook, so I have a personal page, but I also have my True Consequences page, which is True Consequences Pod. I'm on Twitter at True Cons Pod. I'm on Instagram at True Consequences Pod. And I'm on TikTok now, and I'm like old, but I'm doing it. I'm on TikTok.
I'm learning TikTok too, and I have to get my 8-year-old daughter to help
use
me.
YouTube, like, how to learn how to do that
screen thing. Like, what's happening?
So I'm not completely inept, but it's Eric Carter Lundin on TikTok. Today, Jacob's video that I posted has almost 20,000 views, which is pretty exciting. But I need more. I need more exposure on this case, and so that would help, as well as signing the petition, and just help me amplify Jacob's voice, because he has been ignored for too long, and he deserves justice. He deserves, the person who hurt him deserves to be in jail. He deserves to pay for what he's done to my brother, to my mom, and to countless other victims, I'm sure.
And for those victims that wouldn't be able to come forward to watch him finally pay, yeah.
Brownie,
would be
jump
some
on
justice
with her.
For themselves.
I'm sorry?
What healing are you doing?
Well,
what healing are you doing?
My show is helping
you
a lot. with this because I'm amplifying the voices of people who have been mistreated by the justice system in New Mexico. And there was a case that I covered that a young girl was being abused by her dad. And nobody would listen to the mom because she had a past. And since the episode aired, I believe it was Monday night or Monday afternoon, the father was arrested. Those things are very...
That's amazing.
Well, I can't take all the credit.
Good job.
But I do... That heals.
Huge credit.
That helps. And I'm also in counseling because I need it.
I would like to thank everyone that stayed and listened to Jacob's story today. Both I and Eric are very grateful. We know that this story was a hard one. I was able to do this amazing interview live on Get Vocal. I highly recommend downloading the app, watching the shows live, being able to be a part of the show. I definitely recommend, like I said before, to please go find True Consequence Pod. Subscribe, download, help Eric share Jacob's story. The simplest action of just hitting share, retweet, makes the biggest difference in these cases. And again, like always, until next time.